among those killed was an Irishman, my husband, Brian O'Callaghan Westrop. We were on our honeymoon at the time, just 4 days after our wedding. Devastated to find myself suddenly widowed and alone, I also had severe injuries to contend with. I was rescued, seconds from death, by a volunteer fireman who risked his own life to save mine. But I still suffered life-threatening burns all over my body. I was considered one of the lucky ones to have survived at all. That is from Zoe Holohan's remarkable book, After the Fire, and it's a remarkable story, a tragic, tragic story. And Zoe wrote on Twitter yesterday, "I tried to look away and avoid the news channels, but I'm transfixed by the footage of the Greek fires. My heart is breaking, witnessing such pain and destruction. It's like watching a repeat of Matty 2018. All we can do is watch and pray and hope people will escape to safety." Zoe Holohan, good afternoon, Zoe.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
Good. Well, how are you, more importantly? I know anyone that read your book, you do not need a reminder or a prompt to be reminded of your wonderful husband, Brian. But these days, as you say yourself, brings it all back in such awful, awful, tragic images and pictures. Have you been in touch with anyone in Greece in the last few days, Zoe, or vice versa?
Yeah, I have. And in fact, I was just talking this morning. Well, when I say talking, I mean emailing Manos, who is the man, Manos Saliagos, who's the man who saved my life, as you know.
The fireman, yeah.
Yes, and he's actually a volunteer, a civil volunteer. Yeah. And so we stay in touch quite frequently. And I've also been speaking to quite a lot of people from Greece over the last few weeks. In fact, I was waiting for the footage to arrive. That sounds really macabre, probably. But so many people have been writing to me explaining what's going on over there at the moment. And these little fires have been erupting here, there and everywhere. Up to this morning, I believe it's something like 550 fires across the whole France of Greece. So this has been going on a little bit longer than we're witnessing on this side of Europe. But it's horrific. It's absolutely horrific.
And what was Manos saying? Is he? It's not in his area again, is it?
It is.
Oh, it is.
And
oh,
I mean,
God.
Yeah, because it's all around Athens. So, I mean, he was sending me photos of children being thrown in cars, you know, watching their homes basically go up in flames in front of them. Images of civil volunteers collapsing on the side of the road, you know, from sheer exhaustion. I mean, these people aren't the heroes, the very definition of heroes. They're risking their own lives, like he did for me. They're risking their own lives. And actually, funny enough, this just shows you the mark of the people that they are. He was contacting me to check in to see if I was okay, because he knew I was looking at the footage. So that shows you how kind and compassionate, you know, these people are.
And have any lessons been learned, Zoe?
I don't know. And I'm going to be honest with you. Some of the conspiracy theories that have been reaching me from certain factions over there are just jaw dropping, and I won't go into them I'm hoping are totally wrong. But there definitely seems to be a major element of human error here. Obviously, we've all been watching this Code Red report that the IPCC brought out yesterday. And I mean, without a doubt, it's, you know, global warming, they said it was going up to, what, late 40s over the last few days in Greece. I mean, clearly, if it's like a tinderbox, that's not going to help matters. But there's something strange going on. I mean, if these fires are so sporadically placed all across the islands, there's something awry. I just, you know, I have to be cautious as well about what I say there, because you know, you want to be careful not to point fingers, but something strange is going on.
But to go back to 2018, not that you need a prompt, as I say, to be reminded of the horror every single minute of every single day. Like, there was one of the arguments at the time was that the fire had been started, not deliberately, but by a farmer who's, and it happens here as well, farmers burning brush or whatever. There has been a public inquiry launched, a pretty serious one in Greek terms. What is the update on that, Zoe? Are you kept abreast of that?
I am and I am, and in all honesty, because with COVID, there was a major court case, as you know, which ensued back at the end of 2019. And there were several hundreds of us. So it's a group suit, basically, to try and discover what happened. And there were certain major errors of judgment that happened along that line. But so far as I've been informed, it's been a stop-starter, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. 1 minute they say, yes, we've got the villains of the piece, and then no, they get away with it. And look, to be honest with you, I'm not knowledgeable enough. I have a theory in my own head, but I'm not knowledgeable enough of the politics on the place. But one thing I will say is, you know, there were serious errors that were made on July 23rd in Mati that I know the Greek people will not mind me saying. There were roads that were blocked off. The electricity was cut off. We were basically sitting ducks. And when I say 102 people died, but thousands of people were affected. You know, their homes, their livelihoods, everything was just wiped out. It was, you know, nuked, basically. And it's happening now, but to many more thousands of people over there. So it's a helpless feeling watching this happen in live time and not being able to do anything. And I do think it's interesting that a lot of the journalists have been contacting me this week, and maybe they kind of feel like I could be a spokesperson over here for them. I don't know, but there's a connection there.
But it all happened so quickly in York. And everyone says that afternoon. So one minute you're by the pool, the next minute you're resting, and the next minute you're trying to get out of the gate of your villa. And had you been given any directions about where to go? I know there was a problem with the gate because the electricity had been cut off.
So no, there were no directions. There were no warnings. I think one thing that that's really affected me is when I'm looking at the footage and I'm almost talking to the television saying, well, that's what it was like, that there's such poor visibility. That it's almost like that midnight sun that's happening over there. Like the sun is on fire, the sky is on fire, but what you can't see is that thickness of smoke. So, you know, for people that are fighting for their homes at the moment, you know, and trying to escape, yeah, they may escape without burns, but they will have lung damage. You know, it was like literally like breathing in acid. Is the only way I could describe it. Your ears, your eyes, your nose, your throat and lungs hurt. So it's very difficult, as I described in the book, to move around in those circumstances. And it's also very, very confusing because your visibility is so poor.
And when did you I know Brian that heard the commotion first and he shouted up to you, come quickly, let's get out. But did you realise then how the portents, what was coming, the catastrophe that was coming so quickly?
No, because never in your wildest nightmares could you imagine something like this would happen. I mean, we were 4 days married. We were, you know, totally chilled out, obviously. Yeah. We'd had a lovely morning. And then, as you say, we were upstairs for a siesta. Brian came down before me. And by the time he came down, and this is where it gets a little baffling because I'm not really sure what the timeline is. I don't know how long we were asleep. We could have been asleep 10 minutes or we could have been asleep 2 hours. I don't really know. I have an idea of the timeline of the fire, though. I mean, when I got downstairs and saw Brian standing there by the patio doors, the whole side of the villa was on fire. The whole garden was on fire. And I mean, I'm talking fire. I'm talking what you're seeing on the television right now. I'm not talking little smoulders here and there. We're talking big raging flames of fire. So it was seconds, you know, it took us at most, I'd say 2 minutes to grab the very essentials like the passport, the car keys, etc., and get the hell out of there. And then unfortunately, as you know, electricity had been cut off, so our safest mode of escape was cut off to us because we couldn't use the car. So
and then you ran back in because you've been told by that wonderful woman who owned the villa,
Aliki.
I was going to cook a meal for you. That she said, you'll get a handle under the sink or whatever if it ever breaks. And
the old Allen key,
and it didn't
big
work.
Big old crank of a yoke. Yeah. No, and you know I mean, we wasted time. We wasted minutes. Because by the time we realized that this gate was not going to open, the car was surrounded by flames. So we had no option then. There was nowhere to go. And you know, one of the really horrible things is that, you know, one of the very many what ifs that kept me up at night was, I wondered often if we'd gone back into the villa, would Brian still be here? Because the villa was one of the very few properties. I mean, if you, back then, and of course I had this morbid fascination, you know, of Google Maps, you could see the villa was the one, the, pretty much the only property left standing on that entire street. Because it was made of heavy stone. A lot of the houses weren't around that area.
And was there, was there a basement in it, Zoe?
No, did it have basement? No. And I was also told that the smoke would have got us before anything else would have spilled. And the contents, like the inside of the villa, was destroyed, but it didn't burn down, is my point. The structure remained. Yeah, so are the sort of things that you torture yourself with.
Smoke gets most people before fire does, as you know. So you climb over the gate and you're now running, but you don't know which direction to run in.
No, it was absolute chaos. And, you know, we felt like we were the only people on the planet at that stage. That's the strangest thing. All you can hear are these, you know, this intense roar of fire. It's like having a plane engine right next to your head. Yeah. So that's all you can hear. You can hardly see your hand in front of your face. And, you know, we ran to the left and then we ran down towards what we thought were the sea and then we had to come back up. And I described these, you know, small groups of people popping up like visions almost, you know, out of nowhere, out of the smoke, and then disappearing again. And you never know, well, did they make it?
Yeah.
You know, or where did they go? And of course, in the midst of us running around in circles, my dress caught fire and Brian helped put it out. And, you know, it was getting to a very, very desperate stage. But we still had hope. I was always convinced all the way along, as moronic as that may sound, you know, if Brian promised me we were going to be okay, I was convinced we were going to be okay. He was a problem solver. You know, one of these people that will get things done. So if he says, we're going to get through this, I trusted him. And I was, of course, asking him to make an impossible promise. But
he was, used to it in one sense. He was used to emergencies because he did, didn't he do the blood run on his motorbikes voluntarily?
Yes. With blood bikes. And I mean, that kind of sums up the type of man that he was, you know, because Brian would give all his spare time to that charity and he just loved helping people. And he wasn't a bragger, you know, you wouldn't know that he did this. And he'd, you know, he'd do his full week's work and then he'd be up half the night driving around the country. Yeah. Now, mind you, having said that, he did love his motorbike.
I know, there was a modicum of pleasure in that too. So I'm just trying to get a glimpse of through you, Zoe, and the way you told your story so remarkably in that book after the fire. After the smoke cleared, give me the proper name now off the top of my head.
As the smoke clears.
You give such vivid, but you're now running around down the road. You see a car eventually and you try to get yourself into the car, but then what's it, three children appear out of nowhere.
It was five of them. And you know, it was so confusing at the time that I couldn't tell you if it was three, four or five, but I found out much later from the man who saved my life that it was five children that we found on in the middle of the road.
And yourself and Brian insisted on getting them into the car. So the only place for you to throw yourself in was the open boot of a saloon car.
Yeah, which I describe as our coffin, really, because it was, it was a small car. We were two grown adults. There wasn't enough room for the pair of us in there. Probably wasn't enough room for one of us in there. And we just wrapped our limbs around each other and held on for.
Is that the lion gun?
And then obviously as you know, being in the boot and the car crashed and Brian fell out and a tree, huge burning tree, just came down on top of us.
But one of the other elements of this story, which I want people to really hear, is when they think of Greece, in the last few years, they do think of chaos and panic and people at odds with each other, the collapse of the economy, the riots on the street, the death of bank workers and who were trapped in a building. That's what 10 years ago at this stage. But you were, and it comes across in your book, you were so impressed, beginning with that volunteer fireman who saved your life. Tell us about how he saved your life.
Yes, and I mean, he thought I was dead. So when he came through, and it was almost like the shadow of a human came through a wall of fire. And at this stage, now this would only be moments after Brian died. So when Brian fell out onto the road, he just was basically engulfed in flames and he was gone. And I thought I was gone, you know, so I really did not, I thought I wouldn't be far behind him, let's put it that way. And my whole body at that stage was burning. And I lay very still in this boot, and the man Manus, the Manus Aliagos is his name. He saved everybody in the car. Nobody in the car was badly injured. Thank God the kids were fine. And he came across the open boot, and he thought I was dead, except my right eye flickered, because my left side of my face was now very badly burned at that stage. But my right eye flickered. Just imagine, just my eye flickered, and that's what saved my life. And he swiftly just lifted me up and carried me through, again, the only way I can describe it is walls of flames, like everything was on fire all around us. So imagine how brave you would have to be, you know, to actually go through that to save total strangers. And as you say, the compassion that I encountered from so many people over there, I kind of fell in love with the Greek people, to be honest with you. Yeah. You know, the kindness that I experienced in the hospital. Do you remember I was writing about the little things the nurses used to do? They'd do anything just to try and put a smile on my face. They all came in one day and my hair was a disaster because it basically melted. There were those ridiculous long hair extensions. You know, I'd just got married, so I had the whole kit and caboodle attached to my head. And it was like this big matted nest with twigs and all sorts of things in it. And the nurses were determined. They decided that this would cheer me up. And bear in mind, I've been in intensive care at the time. So they all bring in these homemade elixirs to try and... It became like a competition between them to see who could salvage.
Didn't they dragoon someone in to try? I know how your hands were badly damaged. But to work on your nails and try and do bits and pieces just to...
The nails were acrylic nails. I'll never forget, the funniest thing was there was this big burly guy called Vasily, and he worked the desk in ICU. And in ICU, we're all in our little glass cubicles. Yeah. So I couldn't move my head. I couldn't move my body, but my head was kind of slightly upright to aid my breathing. So he was always in my mind shot, my eyesight. And when this girl came in and they were trying to save my left hand, Mr. Moutoukalis, who was my surgeon, was trying to save my left hand. And they brought in this girl, a beautician, to remove the nails because they had tried everything and anything they could. And the nails had curled down and they were basically cutting right into my hand. Yeah. And they needed the nails gone. And the funniest part of this was the look of unadulterated horror on this poor guy's face as he watched this girl, it's effectively like a kanga hammer, working away on these, and there were plumes and smoke and everything. I remember thinking, guys have no idea what women will go through for a bit of beauty, so it didn't bother me at all. But he looked, and he must have seen terrible things in ICU, but yeah, that seemed to be very shocking.
But it was a great sense of the Greek people at every level rallying around and trying to help, and I presume that spread across communities as well, and hopefully that's there now. Though I know the people are very angry. The Prime Minister had to give an address to the nation last night to try and assuage some of the anger, and a lot of the people are saying, why has this happened again? And you can't just put it down to climate change every time something happens. There has to be a response prepped and organised and ready. Have you been back to Greece since, Zoe?
I have. I went back very briefly. Just to actually attend the judge, to attend the court.
Okay.
And so I had to make a deposition about my experience and about Brian's death, and to describe to them in great detail exactly what happened that day. So there were several hundred people whose depositions were being t- taken. And then, of course, COVID hit. And so, you know, the idea was that I was supposed to be going to and fro. But naturally, nothing has happened over the last 18, 19 months. But I, the unfortunate thing is I didn't get the chance to see Mr. Moutkalis and all the wonderful people in the Matera Hospital. I didn't get a chance to see Manos, even though I'm in I'm in touch with all of them, actually, to be honest with you. And, you know, when you're describing the Greek people, I think it's really tantamount to, it shows you how good these people are, that the amount, you wouldn't believe the amount of messages that I still get 3 years on, you know, and particularly around the anniversaries, around the wedding anniversary in July, and then Brian's death anniversary 4 days later. You can imagine July is my least favourite month of the year. But I mean, I just got hundreds of messages from people, local strangers, just saying, "Listen, we're thinking of you." And okay, I mean, that's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, it's incredible. And what you did, Brian was a most it's a love story to Brian, a love a love poem to Brian. Your book is, and your life since, but also, it is an incredible. Telling of a story where lessons can be learned. And then I'm thinking, you say about July and Brian and the 103 people who died, and your wedding anniversary, Brian's anniversary of his death just passed 3 years. But when you were in hospital in Greece, 3 weeks, was it 3 weeks later your father suddenly passed?
Yeah, in fact, his anniversary is on Thursday. So dad passed away on the 12th of August. Look, I can't explain to you how cruel life can be, because I literally, it was just like that was the final blow to me. It's like the fuse just went in my brain, because I couldn't believe that, you know, that could happen. And my dad and I were extremely close, you know.
Another remark. Stay there, Zoe, if you could, please. I'm talking to Zoe Holohan, and it's in connection. Zoe tweeted today about the Greek fires. 3 years ago, at the end of July, she got married, and as she say, 4 days later, her honeymoon, herself and her husband were engulfed in the relatively same area, the type of fire that's now engulfing Greece. And Zoe is telling us what happened, and also speaking in praise and love of the Greek people. Joe at rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
I'm talking to Zoe Holohan. Zoe is the Irish woman who, on her honeymoon 3 years ago in July, was engulfed in the fire. The Matti was the word, M-A-T-I was the area, and 103 people died, and now Greece, it seems, is going through a very similar horror story. Zoe's husband, Brian O'Callaghan Westrop, died in the fires, and Zoe wasn't. How long were you in hospital between Greece and Ireland, Zoe?
I left hospital, as in I've been living in hospitals basically until the end of October. So it was around Halloween when I left the St. James's unit. So I went from Matera for about a month. And then, as you may recall, I ended up in a delightful coma and had an all new fight for survival, because I caught a horrible, horrible sepsis called toxic epidermal necrosis. You can imagine the amount of times I've had to practice saying that. It doesn't roll easily off the tongue, I can tell you. So then I had to, I came back to Ireland, and I was, I suffered from multiple organ failure and ended up in a coma for about a month. And then a few months later, and then I had to do the whole thing again, learning how to walk, talk, breathe, you know.
Yeah, and you do explain in your book, and it's a difficult, there's incredible difficulty, but this is a difficulty that came from elsewhere. You do explain in your book where you were almost told if you didn't take the air ambulance home, that the insurer wasn't going to look after you.
Yeah, I think there was a combination of factors at play there, though. My father, as you know, had just died.
Yeah, okay.
And my mum was distraught. And I had got into a stage where I pretty much had decided I wasn't leaving the Matera Hospital.
Because it was so good. They were so good and so loving to you. And
And I was felt safe there. I cannot describe the sheer terror I felt all the time. And I can tell you right now, it's taken years to shake that feeling off. So the idea of leaving my very safe, closeted place in the Matera, where I had, you know, 24/7 care. But bear in mind as well, by the way, I was in surgery every 2 to 3 days. So it saved my eyes, my face, my legs, my arm, my hand. So it was constant surgery. So I suppose my thought process probably wasn't the clearest. I didn't want to go home. And I didn't want to face reality. I didn't want to go back to Ireland, because then I knew I'd have to really understand and live with everything that had happened. But yes, eventually my older brother, God love me, as the patience of a saint, eventually just said, Zoe, it's time to come home. And he said, Mum needs you.
But it was a terrible medical setback. And when you did arrive back and you went into a coma, and as you say, multiple organ failure. So you were in a hospital. Are you still attending St. James?
Yeah. I actually had a surgery at the beginning of July, rather. I tell you, it was actually hilarious, because it was like a little reunion in my room. I got to see so many nurses that I had, because of COVID, that I hadn't seen, because I used to drop in and out, you know, quite frequently anyway, because I'd be undergoing ongoing occupational therapy and physiotherapy, etc. So it was lovely. It was lovely to see them all again. And we had a good old giggle, because I wasn't apparently the easiest of patients at times.
No way.
No, really. I'm not a paragon of virtue. But it was so
delightful. And how did the most recent operation go? Which is three years later.
Yeah, it's one of a few. Yeah, but it's, look, this is what's hard to describe to people. You know, I suffered severe third and fourth degree burns right down to my bones, you know. So the leg, my left leg is where we operated on. I don't want to turn anybody off if they're having a late lunch or whatever, but they basically removed tissue and cells and fat and all sorts of stuff from my stomach, and then are trying to remold my left leg to give my leg to basically help with the disfigurement. And it's the first of a few. And let's put it that way.
And Zoe, how did you manage, and how are you managing during the pandemic, during the lockdown?
Well, in a weird way, it was almost like a gentle buffer back to reality. You see, I mean, it's really hard to describe how isolated I'd been anyway. You know, I kept myself to myself. I had my little crew of friends, and I was in and out to hospital every 3 or 4 days, you know, for the first year after leaving hospital. So it was kind of a gentle introduction back into, I suppose, society. And then obviously COVID hit. So the irony is, you know, I mean, I really was ready to go March 2020, but that's not the way the world worked. But I, you know, I can write. So that's what I'm happiest doing. So that's how I've been preoccupying myself and spending my time.
Because you can
I can tell you, I've got itchy feet now to get back to reality now and get back to normal, whatever normal life is, like all of us, I suppose.
And by the way, you say you can, you like writing. You're stunningly brilliant. And that's one of the things that I felt during the, obviously you were committed to programs and that, but I really felt the book was so powerful, so abundantly powerful and moving. And I think the bookshops were closed. I couldn't recommend it highly enough. And it's not about, for you, it wasn't about selling books, because, you know, there's no money in books unless you're J.K. Rowling, but it wasn't about selling books. Yeah. It was telling the story, and it was in honour of Brian, of this remarkable man. And of course,
It was his legacy. Yeah. It was his legacy. Yeah. You know, I wanted the world to know what a great man was lost. And it keeps his memory alive. And, you know, even as heartbreaking as when stories, you know, pop up every now and then, you know, about the fire, I get to see his face. It just makes me smile every time I see his face in print, you know, or on a website. I have to say something now. Don't think I'm being overly schmaltzy here, but I will say one thing to you, because I've never had the opportunity to say it. So you were one of the very first people to read the book. And I was, I can't describe what a nervous wreck I was. If you can bear in mind, I was living the life of a hermit. And then all of a sudden I was going to be on television and I was going to be talking about this book, you know, and it was a very intimidating, scary process. And then you sent me the most beautiful card. And this all happened on the week. But it happened just before the book was going out on sale, because obviously, you know, you got one of the very early copies. You've been, you know, very.
And I remember, I think I read it, as they say, in one sitting. I just, and I immediately started spreading the book around. I just said, this is a.
Well, the card gave me such a boost. You have no idea, because I had no confidence whatsoever, and you know, just. To see that, and it was wonderful. You could not have timed it or put more beautiful words down on paper.
And Zoe, are you during the lockdown, have you continued writing?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. It's an obsession now.
Great. So what is it? What is the?
Well, I'll give you a laugh. I've started book two about six different times. Yeah, book two has gone off in all sorts of tangents, but now I finally decided I know exactly where I'm at. So I'm entrenched in the second book now, and I'm kind of excited about it, to be honest with you. So it's I'm sticking with nonfiction. I've decided.
Great, yeah.
I've put the fiction one to the side for the moment. And I don't want to give too much away because I'm only at the very early stages, but it will be involving some of the incredible individuals that I've met on my journey since the fire.
Okay.
So I've been very lucky. I've met some rather unusual and deep souls since all of this has happened. So they've been little gifts along my path. So there are some fascinating stories that I want to share.
And you made great efforts. So, for example, Manos, the firefighter, did you contact him through Facebook? Was it? How did you find him?
Yeah, he found me, actually, and I'd obviously avoided social media for so long after the fire. And eventually, when I did go back on it, there was this DM waiting for God knows how long, months and months. And I was very cautious, you know, to contact anybody just in case it was a journalist. But anyway, I did my checking. When I saw on his Facebook page how proudly he had the letter from Leo Varadkar, because Leo wrote him a beautiful letter of thanks on behalf of the people of Ireland for saving me, I realised it had to be him. So yeah, we communicate in, you know, on Google Translator emoji. I don't speak Greek.
Of course, you know,
first language either, so it's kind of sometimes conversations can be a little, you know, topsy-turvy.
And what about that incredible, I'm trying to remember, who did you say he was like? Omar Sharif, was it the surgeon? Give me his name again.
Mr. Mutuglis.
Yeah.
Yes. I think I said he was more like Tom Selleck, though.
Okay.
Although now that you say it, he does have a Sharif-esque type of man.
But he is the man, if again remind. He is the man who said to you, and it was at that stage you're in a private hospital because you needed it in that sense. But he's the man who said to you, Zoe, you will never leave this hospital. I don't care if you don't have a, you are not going to leave this hospital without my say so. He gave you that reassurance that he would be there for, as all the staff were, as long as you needed it, not as long as you could pay for it. I just think it's the Greek people come out of your book remarkably well, and that's a great boost. I know it's a terrible time for them again.
And you know, you get these ideas though about surgeons. You get these ideas about surgeons being like having godlike complexes, and you know, particularly plastic surgeons. I've never encountered such compassionate individuals, but Mr. Mutuglis in Greece and Mr. Shelley here in Ireland.
Yeah,
I mean, these
St.
are the
James's,
kindest
yeah.
humans. Yes. I mean, he performed my most recent surgery again, you know, and I mean, these are the people that put everything into their job just to put people like me back together again.
And do you
with such compassion and love and kindness, you know. So
as you say, it's 3 years later, but up to quite recently, you've had an operation. So how many surgeries have you gone through? Do you even know at this stage?
Yeah, I kind of roughly think it's certainly over 30 anyway. So, and they'd be major surgeries.
30
now, so
times.
Procedures.
Before procedures we got procedures, 100. Yeah. But 30 times under a general anaesthetic.
Yes. Yeah. So. So I'm a dab hand at anaesthetics. So sure, I'm practically a surgeon myself. I've been in the theatre so often.
People are queuing up. They just want to say hello to you, but I will just take one before the break. Joe Whelan. Joe, you're listening to Zoe Holohan.
Yes, I am, Joe.
And you're stoned. What
I'm, you, I'm speechless. I'm finding it difficult to say the words. This is the bravest thing I've ever heard.
Thank you.
It's the bravest thing I've ever heard. I'm stunned by the story. You've taken him. I can't believe the things you've gone through and all the time. You mention other people, you know. You're
all the time.
I want to get the book.
It's called As the Smoke Clears, and it's I think it's the subhead is tells us a lot as well, Joe, about the book. It's the inspirational true story of surviving Greece's deadly wildfires, overcoming devastating loss, and discovering a path to hope and renewal. And I hope your next, I know it's not about books, but I really think it's important if you find it therapeutic, Zoe, and you have a gift, which you have, obviously. I really hope and renewal, that last line there, I half suspect listening to you is where we're heading in the next book. But
that's the plan. Okay. That's definitely the plan.
Joseph, thanks indeed. That's Joe Whelan, and thanks for your heartfelt words and there. He's speaking for so many people I see here on the screen. But Zoe, I let you go again to get across to people that the Greek people are good and decent and organised people. They're trying their best. The questions will be asked, as would be asked here. What lessons have been learned since that awful tragedy 3 years ago, which robbed you of your husband of what, only 4 days, Brian O'Callaghan Westrop. And Zoe Holohan, thank you so much. Thank you so much. And
thank you, Joe. And it's lovely talking to you.
Likewise, for the first time. Kind regards, if you can, to all the Greek people that you're in contact with. They are
absolutely, and I do, and I send them. That's exactly what I've been sending them. I'm saying the Irish people are sending their love to you.
Okay. So and to you as well, Zoe. That's a remarkable Zoe Holohan. Thank you, Zoe.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And Joe at RT.ie. Straight to Dublin Airport, Anna Moore, who's been with us now for over a week, the mother of Irish boxers, a boxing judge. Anna, tell us what's happening in Dublin Airport.
Oh, it's chaotic out here. There's crowds out here to welcome the Irish team, Kelly and Aidan Walsh, home. It's brilliant. Her clubs are here. There's so many clubs here from all over Ireland. It's brilliant to see it.
And Kelly has landed, and
Kelly has landed, and Aidan Walsh and the Irish boxing team, they're all here. Our president, Mr. Dominic O'Rourke, is here. CEO, Fergal Carew, and chairman of the board, Kieran Kerwin. They're all here, and they're all off the plane. All our coaches are off, and our manager and the whole lot, they're all off.
Okay, and they landed on a Dreamliner, appropriately enough. And
they landed an hour early, actually.
Great. And most of the talking has been done, rightly so, given the world we're now living in, out in the open air.
Out in the open, out the back.
And did you get to touch the medal, Anna?
Oh, God, I did, because, they weren't letting me in the beginning because they said it was only families.
Yeah,
but Yvonne had asked me yesterday if I go with them, but I was going with my boxing, the president of the boxing, Dominic O'Rourke.
Yvonne didn't
want to let us in. They said we had to stay outside. But Kelly's mother insisted that they let me in.
Well,
I got in. So it was just in a corridor, the two families, Aidan Walsh's family and Kelly's and myself. And they came out and we got our hugs and our kisses and everything. And then they were brought out. The families were brought around the back out. And they were brought out to meet all the people outside. And a rapturous applause. Oh, it was brilliant. It was brilliant to see them. It just was brilliant. And they're still here, and there's still hundreds here.
And they're given, but I see, in fairness, the DAA staff are keeping people well separated.
They are.
But what's the plan now? I see Mandy there as well.
Mandy is there as well.
What's the plan? She's giving a press conference.
And then I would think I would think they'd probably go back to Port St. Roe. I don't know.
Okay, but you,
I don't mind. I'll be going back to Limerick because I got to meet her. I got to give the girls their flowers like I always did, and I was happy doing that.
Well done. And how did Kelly look? She tired.
Oh, she looked fabulous. They're all tired. It was a long journey home for them. You know, they're tired. But they're elated. They are so elated. And when Kelly came out and saw that crowd, she was taken back by the crowds that were here.
Wait until she sees the inner city this evening. Wait until she sees Summerhill,
Portland
Road,
well,
North
Strand. She well deserves it, you know. And I mean, the boxing community here, our president, Mr. O'Rourke, and that, they would love to have had her back at the stadium.
Of course,
and had
know.
To give her something, but they were told over COVID that they couldn't do it, you know, and they're disappointed over it, but we have to stick by the rules.
It's a remarkable part of the world down around Portland. Well, I was just working out this morning. We've Kelly Harrington, gold medalist, Olympian, gold medalist.
Yeah.
We've Emmett.
Yeah.
Emmett Brennan,
he was a great boxer. Do you know something, Joe? I really believe that to tell all young people out there, if you have a dream, follow your dream.
Yeah.
Because look at Kelly Harrington. She didn't think it'd come true, but my God, it's after coming true for her.
It sure is. So she goes, the inner city parade, and it's be like a Patrick's Day parade, but they're primarily encouraging locals to turn out, which will begins at Clonliffe House there, just down from Croke Park. That begins at 5 o'clock.
And I hope she'll enjoy it because she deserves to enjoy it.
And
she
she'll be
really
on the open top bus. People can see her. They won't
Isn't
be able
marvelous?
To.
I think that's marvellous for her. I really...
But
and you
see,
know, and can she get, she deserves... She's a credit to Portland Road. She's a credit to Dublin. She's a credit to her club and she's a family and Ireland. And I am so proud of her and I love her and I love all my girls to bits. And they're all here, not just Kelly and them back, but all the other boxers that are in high performance, our youth that we're hoping we might get more funding for, Joe. We need it badly for our youth.
And all of our Olympians, anyone, as I said yesterday, anyone that participated in the 2020 Olympics in 2021 in Tokyo, it's something they can wear with pride for the rest of their lives,
They're all Olympians.
But I'm just thinking, you see, in that short run that bus will do from Clonliffe House around onto Portland Road, it's a remarkable part of the city. I'd say Kelly Harrington is from there. Emmett Brennan is from across from Kelly.
That's right.
Barry Keoghan, that incredible actor, is from the flats. Troy Parrott, and Wes Hoolan are from the same street.
That's right. Wes Hoolan played soccer for Ireland.
And then Then I'm thinking of the acting world. Lynn Rafferty, who was in that RT TV
that's
series.
Right.
Great actress. Yeah. And then they'll pass by the homes of Katrina Crowe, who we all know from National Treasure. And across the road is James Handley, one of our greatest living artists. What a part of the world. What a part of the city.
As Kelly's brother said the other day, and it's true, right, they were saying it's a deprived area. But as her brother said, and it's true, it's not. It's a very rich area
because they're
rich in community. They're rich in sports, as you said. They've had top athletes come out of that small area.
Yeah.
They're rich in personalities. They're just a very good community, Joe.
Yeah, absolutely. And this will give them the boost, as it's given the nation the boost that is needed.
Yeah.
Okay, Anna, the other thing you did for us yesterday, you judged the...
I did.
And you had great fun, I think. And
we had great fun.
So you sent us in... I'm going to let you go on your way because you've given us the results.
I have.
And so you're so helpful to us, Anna. Will you mind yourself? How are you getting back to Limerick?
I'm getting the bus.
Good woman.
I get a lift as far as Kildare Village off of the president, Mr. Dominic Rourke, and then I get the bus. I don't care. Every time the girls are coming home from any competition, Joe, I get the bus up from Limerick. I have the flowers for them, give them their flowers and go straight back. I just want them to know that I'm there for them. And you know, Joe, it's sometimes very important to be there. More important to be there when they lose than when they win. That's when they need you more. You know.
And you're the woman who said, and you gave such a brilliant description last week of when, even when they were very young girls, how you used to be the only woman in the room helping them and looking after their little things and that. Okay, Anna Moore, you're a gold medalist yourself. The
thank
mother,
you very
as
much.
As Kelly described
it. It's a pity now I couldn't have went in for that competition because I would have liked those six people down in Doolin.
Okay, don't worry. We'll look after you, honey.
I don't need anyone to look after
you're
me. My
star.
Kelly got her gold medal, and that's all I care about.
Okay.
Go on, and she's home safely, and that's the main.
Yeah, here.
So I'll talk to you soon, Joe. All
okay,
right.
Petal. To see you, Anna. That's Anna Moore, who's also our judge. Here are the results. Actually, I'll do them after the break.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
In red.
She's done it!
Yes.
Olympic champion, Kelly Harrington. Goal for Harrington. Goal for the darling of Dublin. What an incredible moment. Michael Caruth, Katie Taylor, and now Kelly Harrington, Olympic champion.
Here are the results as determined by Anna Moore, the judge, not just a boxing judge, but a judge of music, a judge of poetry, a judge of song, and a judge of story. Here are our final results from the participants who got on the air yesterday of the hundreds who applied. In a top position, she's gone for Joseph O'Shea, which are his very catchy refrain. When Kelly comes home with the boxing gold, we'll be there. Joe, you will be heading to Seafield Hotel and Spa Resort in Ballymoney, County Wexford, two nights stay, one dinner, and a 45-minute spa treatment plus a swim pool.
Stan McKelly comes home with the boxing gold. We'll be there. And when Kelly comes home with the boxing gold, we'll be there.
Michael Green, with your song, Our Kelly Harrington, you're going to the Viking Hotel on the Cork Road in Waterford for a two-night stay, full Irish breakfast, bottles of bubbly. This is Michael.
We're all delighted with Kelly. We saw her on the telly when she became the Olympic champion. Our Kelly Harrington, our Kelly Harrington. Let's dance. La 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 la.
Brilliant.
You know, there's been times in my career when people say the whole country is behind you. This time I really, really feel the whole country is behind me. And you know, people might say, oh, that's a pressure. You might feel like you have a big weight on your shoulders, you know, like. But I actually really didn't, because I knew no matter what happened out here today, whether it was gold or silver or whatever, I knew I've made myself proud, and I know I've made the people of Ireland proud, regardless of the colour of the medal. Just, you know, just being here and putting our little nation on the map, it's just, you know, this is the stuff of dreams.
Holly Hannon, your wonderful poem, She's Just Magic. We'll see you heading to one of the Talbot Collection hotels for a two-night stay with one evening meal.
In her eyes, we can see the future. She's just magic, a father's voice whispered proudly. Words he had planted into her heart and now into the nation. Like seeds being sowed at springtime, we are scattered one by one across every border, every county, every hometown. In mind and spirit, we stand steadfast with her on that podium in Tokyo, knowing that she did it for us.
Do you know what? I didn't really think that many people would get up and watch it. I thought they would probably rewatch it, you know, because it is quite early in the morning. But it's just, some people say the weight of a nation could bring you down, like could weigh you down, but it really lifted me up, and to have them there. And you know, when I was going into the final, I knew whether I took a gold or a silver, I knew I had made my country proud, I'd made me proud, my family proud, and just the way I've carried myself throughout this tournament, throughout the Olympics, it's just, I'm proud of that, you know, so I'm kind of speechless for words as well.
Philip Corley, your song from Portland Road to Tokyo. We'll see you heading to the Glen Royal Hotel in Maynooth for an overnight and an evening meal. Philip.
From Portland Road to Tokyo, we followed her with pride. Did she know that everyone back home was standing by her side?
Well done, that's Philip Corley. Steve Carey, your poem, Kelly's Gold, has won you four-course lunch for two and from Pat Dunne at the Market Fair, fabulous restaurant in Newbridge, County Kildare.
She worked her way up in the ranks of the best. St Mary's Boxing Club Tala, great thanks is expressed. For this young teenage girl who sought a good path, found love in your sport, and good life has since had.
I feel relief. You know, we're all champions. Anyone who steps in between those ropes are champions. I've had every fight has been a tough fight. Every fight has been a gold medal fight. It's just fantastic. You know, I just can't wait to get back home, sit on the couch to sleep, to rest. I'm absolutely exhausted, to be honest. I mean, I'm like a fluffy pigeon going around. I'm this dark grey at this stage. I am. What a journey. And it's just fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
Absolutely brilliant. Kieran Nolan, you wrote your poem on the spot as you were watching the fight. You were off to the Burren Way Cottage in Doolin, County Clare, with six people for a three-night break for six of you. This is Kira.
The venue more square than ring. My God, did Portadrow sing. Brodach Osgoelga is pride. It looked like you took it in your stride. A winner, you took Olympic gold. A family tale for generations to be told. The anthem brought tears to your eyes. A hero, our champ, Ireland cries.
Well then, Rose Corrigan, thanks for your poem. You were off to the wonderful Clontarf Castle overnight for an overnight in Clontarf in Dublin, not too far from where Kelly is. An overnight stay and dinner for two in their award-winning restaurants. Rose Corrigan.
When the nation was low and under a cloud, you've brought back the sunshine and made us so proud. To the north in our city, you brought such excitation. Our hearts were with you as we watched with elation.
And Anthony Matthew, you're heading off to the Castle Knock Hotel in Dublin for an overnight stay and an evening meal. A big thank you to all our hotels, the Seafield in Ballymoney, the Viking Hotel in Waterford, the Talbot Collection of hotels are all over the country, the Glen Royal Hotel in Maynooth, thank you so much, the Market Fair Restaurant, the Burren Way Cottages, Clontarf Castle once again, thanks, and the Castle Knock Hotel. A big thank you to all our hotels, but above all, a big thank you to every single one of our magnificent Olympians.
Honest, humble, a timid tiger in Tokyo's raring to roar, arises from shadows of boxing, helps a nation to soar. Country awakens amid mild, misty Irish August morn, beholds a battling beauty as sheer brilliance is born.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And Joe at RT.ie. Following on Zoe Holland's remarkable contribution there to start the programme about what happened to her in Greece just over three years ago. Jim Green. Jim, good afternoon. Where are you in Greece?
I'm in a fitness in Greece, which is one of the centre points of the fires that have been raging over the last few days. Of course, that's now spread over towards Evia, which is some distance from us. But I'm listening to and watching the airplanes flying overhead to Marathon Lake, diving into the lake, scooping up water, and then heading off again to Evia.
And as you're, where you work, or indeed where you live, Jim, has that been affected?
Yes, where I live has been very badly affected, whole area. The mountains all around us have been burnt down, Panitha, and all the olive groves and vineyards around us have been destroyed. The house in front of us is gone. The pine forests, of course, are completely destroyed. It's been quite a devastating few days, to be honest.
And how are you managing? How are you faring, Jim, and your friends and family?
We're okay. Thankfully, our house is not damaged, although everything around us is.
Yeah.
We were evacuated on the Thursday night to a place called Kapandrisi, and then evacuated from there to the other side of Attica, which is over by Marathon and the beach side over the other side. So it was a very traumatic night, I have to say, driving along some roads which we did not know of, and you know, with the smoke and everything else.
And
have lessons been learned, Jim, from 3 years ago?
I think so. I mean, you know, so I'm not an expert in this, but from what I can see, the firefighting or the measures put in place were far better than I've ever seen before. Certainly in terms of dealing with population and evacuation, that was very good because, you know, we were told well in time to evacuate. We were all channeled to certain areas. So whereas in the past, as I learned from Matty, there was none of that at all. So I would say that the organization, the emergency sort of planning was actually quite good this time around. Mm-hmm. We were actually sort of directed then on the following day, because we didn't have anywhere to stay, to a hotel in Athens, which is excellent. So we were not short of somewhere to stay. And I think, yes, there will be exceptions. There were some people who say that they were not given accommodation, but I think there would be the exceptions to the rule.
Okay.
And I think there was very good emergency planning all around by the government this time.
And the death toll, the last I saw, I know it was 103 3 years ago, but the last figure I've seen here is from Greece, three, including a firefighter. Again, reminder of the work they do.
Yes, well, the firefighter, that was a very unfortunate incident, as I understand. That was up in the mountains here behind us, where a pole had collapsed and hit him, rather than him being sort of caught in an unfortunate situation by surrounding flames and so on.
But it's a dangerous job. Jim, insofar as you know, what does the next few days hold?
Well, there still are some fires going around, not in our immediate area, but in Evia. So I think, you know, these need to be tackled. But we are expecting some stronger winds over the next weekend. So I don't know what that will lead to in terms of the fire developing. But we also hear from the state that measures will be put in hand to try to look after people who have been badly affected or lost their homes and so on. So we just have to sit tight and see.
And where are you from in Ireland originally, Jim?
I'm originally from Blackrock in Dublin.
Oh, you're down beside us. Have you been long in Greece?
40 years.
40 years. Okay. Oh, you're well settled.
That's more time than I spent.
Okay. Well, we wish you well, Jim. You and your fellow Irish people, also the Greek people, wish you well. It's a terrible. And is climate change being mentioned a lot?
Yes, I mean, climate change is one of the issues that constantly arises, not only internationally but here as well. But we've also had heat waves here for the last couple of weeks, and they will go on for another week or so with temperatures up in the 40s. So, you know, that doesn't help either. But, and, you know, the winter too is a relatively dry winter. So, you know, we've not had the, you know, sort of... how would you say, dampness of soil around too, which might have helped to quell the fires in the earlier stages. And the trees are very, very dry. The trees in Kifisia, for instance, which is the big city area not far from us here, the plane trees are already losing their leaves. Now, for that, this time of year, that's very unusual. You know, that normally happens around about September, October. So you can just see how dry things are here.
Okay, Jim. I wish you well. Your family's still here in Dublin, I presume.
I have. My immediate family have moved on elsewhere. But yeah. I have cousins and my son lives over there with his family. Okay. So I still have that connect with Dublin even after all these years.
Okay, well, it's good. I was glad to hear you're safe and sound, even though you've gone through some trauma, and hopefully it will be sorted out as quickly. But the economic effects, and as Zoe Holland said earlier, is the trauma for people who've been involved in an inferno like that does linger for a long time. But Jim Green, who's in Greece, thanks indeed, Jim. It's Joe at RT.ie if you wish to contact us from Greece, like Jim. David Shevlin, David, it's not fire that is damaging your house, it's the sea, and it's where, David?
Hi, Joe. It's in Portland, North County, Dublin.
Oh, well, only up the road.
Exactly.
And what's happened?
Well, Portland has been suffering from coast erosion for many decades, but in the last decade, it's been so aggressive that it has totally removed the dune structures, which once acted as a buffer between the sea and private property. And now the dunes have disappeared.
Wow.
And now they're eating away at private property, such as my own home. So we've lost in the last couple of years about 20 metres of our garden, which leaves about 10 metres left before our house falls into the sea. A house has already been lost in 2019. A neighbouring house collapsed onto the beach. Now, that was in the media quite a bit. But the area is subject to devastating effects of coastal erosion when we have spring high tide.
And is there anything they can, the council can do? Is there rock armour or any protection they can put up?
Well, this is the pickle, because the area of the Borough Beach in Portland is classified as a special area conservation.
Ah,
okay. So with the special area conservation, they say they are very restricted in what they can do. Mm-hmm. So there is plans afoot to put in sea defences to protect the Borough Beach area. But the timescale for those defences to be put in place are about 5 years away. At the current rates of erosion, we don't have that time.
Yeah, you sure don't. I'm looking at the photographs here. Hopefully we'll be able to tweet them upstairs. But when you got permission for the house, was that mentioned?
No. We coast erosion was not an issue at all when we got planning. And again, we got planning in 2008 to double the size of the house, and it still wasn't an issue. But then there was a storm in 2011, which eroded the public walkway, which used to traverse the full length of the beach. And ever since then, we've just been subject to continual coastal erosion to the point where the dunes are totally washed away. The special area conservation is not really evident. We don't see it because it's now chewing away at my back garden.
It sure is. Stay there if you would, Dave, because I want to bring in Randall Plunkett, who's in Eden Derry. Randall, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And what have you done, Randall, and it's been controversial as well, bizarrely, but what have you done? Because you say you didn't need this report yesterday to alert you to the dangers of what was happening to the world.
Well, I got to be honest with you, Joe. I mean, this is not news to us.
Mm-hmm.
This has been going for a long time. How many years are we going to go with this constant story that keeps coming? And it keeps getting worse every year. Mm-hmm. And we're still not doing enough.
And what have you done, Randall? Because you've done something quite dramatic.
Well, to be honest, I'm an old-fashioned guy, and I believe if you want something right, you've got to do it yourself.
Okay.
So 7 years ago, I decided to embark on a mission, and that was to protect the environment in where I live, in County Meath. And so what I decided to do was I was going to rewild all my grasslands and all my forestry. And at the time, this term rewilding wasn't really a buzzword. In fact, they didn't even call it rewilding. It was called nature conservation.
Okay.
But that's not very sexy, so rewilding's way better. So what we decided to do is we would eradicate all chemicals. We were going to allow all stages of life. That means things were going to grow, things were going to mature, things were going to die, and things were going to rot. That is the circle of life, Joe. I mean, the problem is that carbon is building and building and building, and we keep taking, and we're leaving nothing left. So the circle is not going to conclude itself, and we are going to continuously have problems until we find a solution. And this was a project. It's not so much an idea to change everything. It's to introduce a different solution into the amount, because we have several different ways we can do this. And rewilding is one tool to combat climate change. And I assure you, Joe, we are at war here. It's the most dangerous moment the human race may be facing.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to do something now.
So you've no livestock, you've no planting, you've no sowing.
So we do have, because my project is completely self-financed, we have a working farm now.
Okay.
The estate is about 1,700 acres.
It's insane.
About 750 acres is in rewilding. The other farming pace for the rewilding. So we're completely independent. Our pursuits are mostly science. There's no tourism as such associated with it. That was never the goal. Science, education, and understanding is our goal.
So the effect of, did you ban hunting from your land?
That is correct, yes. There's no hunting.
And what was the reaction to that, Randall, around Dunsany Castle when you banned hunting?
I didn't make too many friends.
Okay.
So the problem is that this is an effort that is ethical. We are trying to do the most we can to preserve the wildlife and the habitats within our country. And there's no room for traditional hunting or any kind of hunting on my property. That's not what we're about. We're about uplift here of all animals and all species.
And the effect of the rewilding, have you seen birds you've never seen before and flowers? Or
I have seen a huge increase of insects, huge increase in birds. I have seen animals I have never seen before. Pine martens are back. Otters are back. I have seen my first woodpecker.
Okay.
And I even potentially have seen a goshawk that we think is in the area.
Okay, wonderful, so, wonderful.
And I never even knew what that was, Joe, before I had to Google it and figure it out. These things are happening, and this has only been 7 years. Imagine what we could do if we did this all over the country.
And Randall, what can we do? What can everyone do? You know the whole argument. On the one hand, what China does every week when they open a new coal-fired electricity generating station once a week. What Barcelona in Brazil is completely bordering on the criminal about the forest, the Amazon forest. How can one person make a difference?
Well, Joe, we're all responsible for our actions. And in the future, when there's no more air to breathe and there's no more animals, and the only way you're going to see wildlife is in a zoo or in a museum, what are you going to say to your children? What did you do?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to say. I'm going to say I did everything I could with what I had. Now, a lot of people don't have what I have, and I respect that. But you probably have a windowsill. Have you got any flowers on that windowsill? Have you got any plants on that windowsill? There's no excuses. Everybody can do something. And we don't have to cut every lawn, and we don't have to use only plastic. We can try and make better choices. Everybody is responsible for the planet. And I can't really speak for Bolsonaro. I certainly didn't vote for him, but I live in Ireland, and we can start working here. And we can all, if we set by example, we can influence the world. We may not be the biggest country, Joe, but we could be the leading country in this idea.
Okay. Randall, did you come to this? Are you a late convert? I know you've had a career as you're into film and you're into different things as well. But were you ever tempted to become like you're a baron? Were you ever tempted to become a country bumpkin, a lord of the manor down there?
God, no.
Okay,
To be honest with you, I didn't even like the countryside when I was younger. and I ate steak every day, and I was into bodybuilding, and, you know, I didn't like getting up before midday. But that's not where I started, is not where I am.
Okay.
And this is, you know, I want to live a better life, and I want this country to be proud of its heritage and its nature. And we're doing a terrible job with the nature side of it. And so I decided that I needed to walk that line. It's very easy to speak about these things, but it's hard to walk them. So I decided one day, out of the blue, I was going to make that change. And I did, and I've been walking that line for 7 years.
Incredible. And you say we're at war. It is with what the world is doing to the world, so to speak, what the people are doing to our environment. But would you said you get hassled who's this from? When does the hunting season start? I don't know, next month, is it? Where is it? We know, August?
Oh, it normally starts in September.
Okay. And when you get hassled when you say no hunting on my land, get lost.
Well, let's just say that I've been getting hassled every year since I took over the place, so I suspect that this year will be no different.
And what's the hassle, what does it consist of?
Look, there's vandalism, there's poaching, there's organized horse hunts that occasionally chop my fences and climb across and start chasing foxes and deer and everything else under the sun. And the thing is, it's they get away every single time because these things are not high priorities. And they should be.
Okay, stay with us. It's Randall Plunkett at Dunsany Castle. One of the, you recognise the name Plunkett. Anyone's into their history, you go back to Oliver Plunkett and Horace Plunkett, rural development. You have a great, and the co-op movement, great lineage in terms of Irish life and politics and community. Jimmy Gallogly. Jimmy, good afternoon. You're a retired maths teacher, lives in Dundalk and the Irish Sea. What are you witnessing in terms of climate change?
Well, I've just watched the news lately and I see all the fires out in Greece and America and Canada's burning up. So, you know, we've all witnessed it. But, Joe, if I said to you, what does retrofit mean?
Okay, yeah, but I haven't got...
Most of us have a sort of a vague idea about retrofit. And every time Eamon Ryan's on radio or TV, he says retrofit, you know. The problem is, you know, most of us can't... First of all, we're not quite sure what retrofit means, but it's obviously, you know, changing our heating
system. So you're saying we need more guidance, we need more...
I believe the Irish people are really in support of saving the planet, but we're not being let do it.
They need practical things. Yeah, I take that point, Jimmy. Say that, Jimmy. Deirdre, sorry for holding you. you say we're on the brink of climate catastrophe. We're on the brink of telephone catastrophe. John, well, come back to you in a sec. John Wilson. John, you installed 16 solar panels on your house. And what's the issue?
Well, there are two issues, Joe, and thanks for taking my call. First of all, I was led to believe that it would be good for the environment, but it would also... more importantly, or as importantly to me, be good for me. It would reduce my electricity bill. It would reduce my consumption of electricity. And better again, I would get recompense for the surplus electricity I was producing. None of that has materialized. Well, sorry, I am getting use of the electricity I'm generating, but I'm generating approximately 200 euros worth of surplus electricity per month. And I'm not getting recompense for it for two reasons. Number one, ESB have not installed a smart meter on my property.
They've installed 400,000 to say it's ongoing. But anyway.
Yes, well, it's not ongoing in my area, and they can't give me a date, time, month, when it's going to happen. I was told when I spent my 10,800 to put in this installation that I would be getting paid from the surplus electricity.
But John, who told you this? The company that put in the solar panels.
The company who installed
A bit more from the ESB statement. There's currently no feed-in tariff available for customers who export. That's you into the national grid. The Department of Environment, Climate, Communication are leading a cross-industry working group on microgeneration, whose members include ESB, Climate Action Delivery Plan. ESB networks are working with customers' electricity supply company to upgrade meters. Now, I know the smart meter... campaign, they're evangelical about it in the ESB, but they still have a long way to go. Just as when you come to electric cars, you can't find chargers on public chargers anywhere. Anyway, I'm over time. John Wilson, Randall Plunkett, Jimmy Gallogly, and Deirdre, who I couldn't get to because of the bad line. Thank you all. Back tomorrow, 1:45, and Lisa Marie Berry produced, and Catherine Thomas is next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. For more on our 212 offers, visit your local Kia dealer or log on to kia.com.
1850 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.